And more times than I can count, I have called you mine. You have stood by me in my
life. Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. We have a lot to share today. We're going to begin with a look at a new, very promising treatment for cancer out of China that you haven't heard about. Then light therapy for damage to the brain, including dementia and Alzheimer's. How you can help keep your heart healthier with vitamin D. And 20 minutes of weekly housework actually boosts mental health. Green tea ingredients, EGCG, significantly inhibits breast cancer growth in this laboratory study. And short-term exercise improves your heart from failing, and a lot more on health and nutrition. Then we're going to take a look at some issues that are not getting the attention they deserve, including the Federal Reserve finally coming out with a report that shows that we have a disastrous financial state in U.S. households. How bad is it? I'll let you know. What can we do about it? I'll share that as well. We recently celebrated an anniversary, a very nefarious anniversary, with the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. When I hear people in the conservative media talk about what this represented and know that they are completely categorically wrong on their history, their facts, I wanted to offer a legitimate challenge so that the next time you hear someone on fascist network, Fox Network, talk about how it was needed, weapons of mass destruction, killing all those people because it shortened the war. Well, what do the experts say who were there, including the top generals, the top admirals, MacArthur, all of them? We now have their declassified papers, so we'll show you that virtually all that we've been told is wrong. I'm sure that most people have not heard of the fourth branch of government. Hold on, we're supposed to have three. Well, Tom Engelhardt in tomsdispatch.com says, no, we have four. We have the powerful, all-powerful, most powerful national security state. Okay, we'll take a look at that, what it means. For those like myself who believe that the United States is directly responsible for funding, training, the so-called moderate terrorist, there is no such thing as a moderate terrorist. But due to the charming personality of John McCain and Lindsey Graham and the neocon warriors, we've been led to believe that spending hundreds of millions or billions of dollars in funding them was a good idea. Well, ISIS is the outcome. And now to go in there and do the airstrikes, okay. How accurate are these airstrikes? What are we not being told? And what would be a better way to approach this? We'll discuss that. We have a lot to talk about. Let's begin. This is from Carolina Wright from Natural News. She found some very important research on what is called Li Gong Ting, L-E-I-G-O-G-N-T-E-N-G. It's also called Thunder God Vine. It's grown in China and Korea and Japan. It's been used for more than 2,000 years, and it's been used to treat cancer. Now, some new research, and this is why I found reading this article important, is because this was done at the University of Minnesota Cancer Center. They discovered that mice treated with this particular vine extract for 40 days showed no further incidence of tumor, even after ceasing treatment. And a chairman of the department, Professor Saljua, said to Bloomberg, quote, you could see every day you looked at those mice, the tumor was decreasing and decreasing, and then just gone, end quote. Scientists at Johns or Johns Hopkins School of Medicine also found extracts of the same identical plant to be effective in eliminating cancerous tumors. And a Professor Liu, Professor of Pharmacology and Molecular Sciences at Johns Hopkins, notes, quote, "Triptyloid has been shown to block the growth of all 60 U.S. National Cancer Institute cell lines at very low doses and even causes some of those lines to die," end quote. By the way, triptylide, T-R-I-P-T-O-L-I-D-E, that's its botanical name. And but as long as you know L-E-I-G-O-N-G-T-E-N-G or Thunder God Vine, you'll know what to ask for. It inhibits colorectal, pancreatic, and ovarian cancers. It's also helped people with rheumatoid arthritis, and autoimmune disease, and multiple sclerosis and lupus. So, this is important and we should be paying attention to it. Light therapy can help slow dementia. Now, we know that dementia is epidemic in the United States. A Dutch team, according to the BBC News, used brighter daytime lighting, with or without melatonin, to improve patients' sleep, mood, and cut aggressive behavior. It concludes that these can slow deterioration in those with dementia. This was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Now, how would this work? Why would light therapy impact dementia? Relatively straightforward. Because what you have is you have a disruption to the body's circadian rhythms. That's the natural cycle that governs sleep and wakefulness. And it can be one of the most difficult of dementia symptoms for carriers to cope with. It can mean that people with the illness can be asleep during the day, but fully awake during the night. Well, if you're a caregiver, you don't want to be up all night. And because that throws your own circadian rhythms off. And other studies have suggested the use of bright room lighting and melatonin can help adjust the biological clock in their brains. And the Royal Netherlands Academy of Arts and Sciences in Amsterdam did exactly that. So they were able to show benefits. So the takeaway message is light therapy and melatonin can make a difference with dementia. If it makes a difference to dementia, there's no reason it wouldn't also help people with memory loss, insomnia, and Alzheimer's. This is from Science Daily, research in the University of Michigan, and here in published in the Journal of Cardiovascular Pharmacology. Quote, "Strong bones, a healthy immune system, protection against some types of cancer. Recent studies suggest there's yet another item for the expanding list of vitamin D benefits. The sunshine vitamin keeps the heart, the body's long-distance runner, fit for life's demands." So in this study, they showed that when you're taking vitamin D, you're also helping the heart muscle cells and from growing bigger, the condition called hypertrophy, in which the heart becomes enlarged and overworked in people with heart failure. So we have millions upon millions of people who have heart failure, which is a progressive, very disabling condition in which the heart becomes enlarged as it is forced to work harder and harder, making it a challenge even to perform normal daily activities. So this is good news and can save lives. For those of you who have to do housework or you actually enjoy doing your housework, according to the latest research on this subject, published in the British Journal of Sports Medicine, just 20 minutes of any physical activity, including housework, in a week is enough to boost mental health. Now, of course, we know we should be doing about an hour a day, but this was a study of 20,000 men and women, and it was the Scottish Health Survey, and that's what they found. So, by all means, do work. Gardening, that counts. Housework counts. Mopping floors, vacuuming. Anything where your body and your muscles are moving. That's the key. And you think, well, gee whiz, why? Why? Because we have become a very sedentary society. We sit at our desks. We sit in front of our computers. We sit in front of televisions. We sit in a car. We're not active enough. A very good study from the University of Mississippi that was reported in Science Daily about the ingredients in green tea, the EGCG. It significantly inhibits breast cancer growth in the laboratory. So that's important. I'm suggesting that if you have 68% reduction in the breast cancer tumor weight using just green tea extract, imagine what it would do to help prevent cancer. Hence, between 200 to 1,000 milligrams of non-caffeinated green tea extract per day, I believe would be an enormous benefit to helping you be cancer-free. Now, once again, there is another report, this one from Texas A&M University College Station and published in Experimental Biology, that shows in patients with heart failure, 1 month of moderate exercise significantly improves heart function and aerobic capacity and at least partially improves related symptoms. So the subjects rode a stationary bike 6 times a week for 14 to 22 minutes. And so that then they were asked to take a brisk walk daily and at 60 to 70% of their maximal heart rate. And how you get your maximal heart rate is real easy. You take your pulse resting. Let's say your pulse is 70. And then what you do is you start to exercise and you take your age and subtract from 220 and then multiply that by, let's say, 65. And that'll give you a good range to exercise your heart in. So let's say you don't want your heart going, if it's normal 70, you don't want your heart racing at 180, that's dangerous. Maybe 120, 130, then it's okay. Doesn't overexert the heart muscle. And finally, a high consumption of the omega-3 fish oils can reduce artery calcification. From the University of Pittsburgh, published in the peer-reviewed journal Heart, the study showed that middle-aged men had lower incidence of coronary artery calcification, a predictor of heart disease, than middle-aged men living elsewhere because they ate a lot of fish, fatty fish. So, quote, the vast difference in heart disease and levels of marine-derived omega-3 fatty acids are not due to genetic factors. When we look at Japanese Americans, we find that their levels of coronary artery calcification are actually higher than the rest of the U.S. population. Multiple studies have looked at the effect of fish oil on cardiovascular health with mixed results. Previous studies investigated substantially lower intake of the omega-3 fatty acids than what people in Japan actually get in their diet. Our study seems to indicate that the level of marine-derived omega-3 fatty acids consumed must be higher than previously thought to impart substantial protection, end quote. So, the takeaway message. You've got to have more of the omega-3 fatty acids. Therefore, if you're 2,000 milligrams a day, that would be good. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health and healing. Have a lot more to come. Please stay with us. Back in a moment.
You never close your eyes anymore when I kiss your lips. There's no tenderness like grief in your fingertips. You're trying hard not to show it. But baby, baby, I know it. You lost that love and feeling. Oh, that love and feeling. You lost that love and feeling. Now it's gone, gone, gone. Oh, oh, oh.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, on the road, but making my way back to the city. Have a lot of stops, a lot of filming, and get there in a couple weeks. And hopefully shortly thereafter be able to have a worldwide premiere of the new feature film on poverty. I have three major films. Each will be shown 6 months apart, and they're on important social issues. Also, for those of you who may not be able to get to a land-based station, because we're hurting land-based stations all across the country, or to the internet, you can always call this phone number and listen in live. So write this number down, please, 401-347-0456, 401-347-0456, or 712-432-7231, 712-432-7231. And I'm going to be doing a study. It's a 3-month study. It's a lifestyle and behavior modification study. It will be medically supervised, but there's no medicine in it at all. It's what we can do to take responsibility for ourselves. I have some new protocols. Those that would qualify to get in would be people who are diabetic, people who are overweight, people who have high blood pressure, elevated cholesterol. Any of those four could qualify you, but you still have to go through an interview process. I'm limiting it to 100 people. It'll be meeting once a week for 3 months. I'll be heading each meeting and starting in mid-September. If you'd like to be considered, I'm going to give you a phone number. You can call in and they will tell you what exactly you have to have. Call 631-504-6198, 631-504-6198. Just a quick announcement before we go into our topics here. On Thursday and Friday, when people tune in the show, they didn't hear me. We had about 411 calls from people asking what happened, since there was no announcement. I'll just be very brief and direct on this. We had, I believe, a successful fund drive. And in fact, on several days, we actually were the top station out of Pacifica's five stations. And that's a very good thing. And of course, this audience led in supporting the station as it has for 38 years. The issue was that in order for me to honor our pledge to get the premiums out as quickly as possible, ideally within 48 hours of the credit card going through at the station, the publishers have to have the books in stock, the tapes have to be made, the DVDs or CDs, so that they can be picked up and mailed out by a great group of volunteers that we respect who come in and do their best, and everyone chips in and helps send out these premiums. And that is the issue. The trouble is for 2 weeks, 2.5 weeks, I was not given any numbers, even though I'd requested, because I have to contact the publishers. The publisher just does not have a bunch of books sitting around, 400 or 500 books waiting to be sent out. Those books are expensive to print, and they're all paid for in advance, so I don't want to burden the publisher. When I did not get any figures in, after repeated request for what are the amounts so I can prepare to ship these out, in retaliation for this, I was simply preempted, which is fine. My hope is that they made more money on Thursday and Friday than what we would have done, and they have a right to do that. I just consider it unprofessional and childish. But then again, that's exactly what I expect and have had to deal with for a long time. My hope is that at the end of the day, all premiums are made a priority, that the people listening have their needs met first. It is this simple. If you neglect the audience and what they really want to hear, what they should be given exposure to in programming, they'll find a place that will meet those needs. If you ask for their money and you take too long to get them their premiums or not at all, and there's no communication with them, then they'll remember that the next fund drive. That is why we have no audience, so to speak. We're dead last in all indices. We've become irrelevant. Many of us, however, are trying to rebuild the audience, and that takes time. And you rebuild an audience by rebuilding confidence from the listeners and let them know you're doing the best you can in their interest. But that has to be a unified effort. And in Pacifica, the audience is dead last. And we all know that. And that's why we have self-sabotaged. And that's why we are where we are at. This was not an invasion of the privileged class, the one percenters, the Rupert Murdochs. That was all a lie. And right now, we're in jeopardy of being sold or leased. There is complete, total chaos at the national level. I've never seen such immature, unprofessional posturing politics in my entire career. And yet this is what we're faced with. So if they do not change radically at all levels in programming, 70% of my opinion would be changed. In accountability, in quality of professional standards, in enlightened discourse, in changing the draconian and completely supercilious ways that the local and national boards are run and get real good professionals in to help the stations, then what we fear, we will create the demise of a once great station. That's all I have to say on it. Let us now go to other issues, including the latest on the Federal Reserve. This is from Andrea Damon, quote, Federal Reserve study points to disastrous financial state of U.S. households. Quote, a typical American household cannot raise $400 without borrowing money or selling possessions, according to a result published just Friday by the Federal Reserve, the U.S. Central Bank. The Fed's report on the economic well-being of U.S. households points to a precarious state of majority of U.S. households who risk poverty or bankruptcy in the event of job loss, accident, or unforeseen medical expenses. And here's my take on this. First, you have to know context and accuracy of reporting. There is no 6% unemployment rate. When you start off by intentionally removing anyone who is a long-term unemployed person but seeking employment, then anyone who has a part-time job, maybe even working 2-3 hours a week, you include them as full-time. Then all those people who did not want to retire, still want to be active, but had no choice because of age discrimination. When you add all that up, you're dealing with at least 26% unemployment rate. But politically, everyone knows that that would make us look like Spain or Greece. So we lie. And then the media picks up on the lie and doesn't challenge it. So that's one thing. Separately, there was a time when we had 51% of Americans worked in unions. Unions represented, and they're not perfect, but they represented a collective bargaining. So at least when General Motors or U.S. Steel or IBM or some other company was had a workforce, they were sure that they would have a living wage, health benefits, and as best as could be at that time, a protection within the environment. And then from there, Ralph Nader and others helped create OSHA and environmental protection so we weren't constantly exposed to asbestos or gases or polluting chemicals. That didn't come from the government, and it didn't come from industry. It came from the activists working within the unions to ensure our safety. Unfortunately, today we're down to 6%, and many of those at the top are corrupted because of greed and because of either the corporate Democrat heading a union that seeks their own self-interest rather than what is best for the country and its members. So what happens today is, if you're working, the likelihood is if you're the average American, you're working at a job where you're not able to pay all your bills and have any standard of living. As a result, when you see people purchasing and you see gross domestic product, a percentage of that has nothing to do with people having money in their savings account, going out and buying dinner, going to a laundromat, going to a mall, going on a vacation, all of which puts money in the economy. What you see is a person using their credit card with no savings. As a result, when you are using debt as a part of the gross domestic product, then it does not give an honest, accurate accounting of our actual asset base. Because since when, except in an extraordinarily disturbed mind, do you consider debt an asset? But that's what we have done. We've mastered the art of making debt, debt accumulation, and debt creation an asset. That's how the equity partnerships work. That's how the hedge funds work. That's how the banks work in fractionalized, where they can take money and spend it over and over and over again, just with a stroke of a keyboard, they can create a loan and work off the interest. The average person can't. You owe the interest. And yet you'll watch a commercial that says, I can buy anything now that I want because I'm getting money back. Yes, you're getting anywhere between 1% to 2% back. You're paying 18% to 28%. To me, that's just insane that you would think that if I give you a 4 cents and you give me a dollar, that somehow you ought to give me more dollars to get more 4 cents back. This is the kind of Edward Bernays propaganda. He was a master propagandist and a brilliant one, and showed television executives and advertisers how you can give a commercial over and over again to where people actually believe it. And so that's how we live our lives, on debt. So what this is showing is that the average American is deep in debt. Our corporations are $26 trillion in debt. Our federal government is $17 trillion in debt. That does not include underfunded or unfunded Medicare and Medicaid. Our students are $1.1 trillion in debt. Our credit card holders are $900 billion in debt. Then you have $16 trillion in mortgage debt and $7 trillion in additional household debt. So you start looking at how much debt we actually have against how much asset we have, then subtract a part of our asset that is created by debt, and you realize that our gross domestic product is probably around $9 trillion, and our debt is about $130 trillion. We're totally bankrupt. There's no way in the world we'll ever get out of this unless someone did the smart thing. Now, what is the smart thing? First, instead of worshiping at the altar of the bonuses and the return on equity and the unmitigated greed of the people in our society, why don't we simply encourage corporations as a part of a whole new goodwill to increase salaries or give a percentage of the profits back to the workers every year? In either way, it comes out the same. You're improving the standard of living. You're giving people an opportunity to live off their savings and not live off their debt. And you're able then, through a national program of forgiveness, forgive the debt, forgive interest on the student debt, let them get out of bankruptcy, change the laws, forgive credit card debt, stop and make it against the law for these completely vulture credit card payday loans and debit card interest rates that can go up to 300 or 400%. And yet the banks that are giving us this money are getting it for 0% interest. So if we really care, we would work together and nationally take one at a time, tear up all your American Express cards, no longer bank at one bank at a time, no longer shop in a Walmart or one store at a time. Take on America one point at a time. Don't vote for any legislator currently in office at any level that has not honored you and your needs. If you're not willing to make those sacrifices to find out what you should boycott and what you should not pay for and what you should not buy, then you're going to continue to be victimized by this. And as a result, we now have 200 million Americans who are living just above, at, or below the poverty level. And that's only going to increase. And with that come the gangs, by the way, because they come when they're home foreclosures and poor areas, because they know when people are unemployed, people are broke, people are desperate, then they want to distress themselves. And how do they de-stress themselves? More often than not, taking drugs. And we have people of all levels of life now taking drugs. We should decriminalize this so it takes the profit and the violence out of it, just like we stopped prohibition, which caused us to have organized crime. From Lucky Luciano and Al Capone and Meyer Lansky, all the people that formed the La Cosa Nostra, that happened because what we wouldn't give people when you give people the right to have it, it's their choice. At least organized crime can't control it. We just need some enlightened moments, and we're just covered in darkness right now. I'm Gary Knoll. One more thing. Here's a statement by Peter Van Buren from Fire Dog Lake. Quote, why airstrikes in Iraq are a mistake. And I want you to think about this for a moment. Because the media, especially the Bill O'Reillys and Sean Hannitys and Mark Levin, they're acting as if ISIS has just arrived. They're a terrorist group. Look at the beheadings. They are a terrorist group. No question about that. And they do beheadings. And they slaughter everyone. They're really terrible as a group and their leader and the caliph. All of this is bad. But what they don't tell you is this. Where do they come from? How did they get all these supplies? How they have all this money? How they have all this training? How about our ally, Saudi Arabia? That's where most of this is coming, and how we help pay for their training and their arms, because we believe them to be the moderate terrorist. It was in Libya, and then when Libya became nothing but a complete destroyed community, that then hundreds of terrorist groups that got Gaddafi's arsenal then went into Syria, and then we funded them in Syria, and now they're in Iraq. Why can't they show the actual historical trail for this? So just remember, as America goes back to war in Iraq with airstrikes, here's what to know and do instead. Mind you, this is a slippery slope if those words have any meaning left. Airstrikes are in part to protect American advisors sent earlier to Erbil to support Kurds there, because Iraq's central government won't. The U.S. is assuming the role of the de facto Iraqi Air Force. What happens next? Next crisis? Next genocide? Where does it end? Understand how deep the U.S. is already in. It is highly likely the U.S. Special Forces are active on the ground, conducting reconnaissance missions and laser designating targets for circling U.S. aircraft and drones. And if U.S. planes are overhead, the U.S. search and rescue assets are not far behind. And perhaps in desert forward operating positions. This is how bigger wars begin. Don't take my word. Go to Google. Vietnam War. Say starting officially in the United States, 1963. It was actually in the 1951, but go back to 1963 and you'll see. The U.S. media is playing the support song, and they're talking about the problems of the Christian minority in Iraq, which is true, as a way to engorge the American people with blood. But the media fails to note that over half of Iraq's Christians were killed or fled during the U.S. occupation. So when the U.S. was occupying and causing the death of these Iraqi Christians, no media paid attention. Now it's different. The only realistic hope to derail ISIS is to alienate them from the Iraqi Sunnis, who provide the on-ground support any insurgency must have to succeed. What was it Mao called a sympathetic population, the water the fish swims in? Separating the people from the insurgents is counterinsurgency 101. Instead, via airstrikes, the U.S. has gone all in on the side of the Iraqi Shias and the Kurds. You cannot bomb away a political movement. If you could, then we would have won in Vietnam. You cannot kill an idea that motivates millions of people with a Hellfire missile. Sunnis are not confined by the borders of Iraq, and this is not a chessboard. U.S. actions towards Sunnis in Iraq or Syria resonate throughout the Sunni world. There is no better recruitment tool for Sunni extremists than showing their fight is actually against the Americans. And throughout the broader Islamic world, the takeaway is that, again, the U.S. unleashes wars against Muslims. Now, nothing can inspire jihad like seeing the struggle in Iraq as one against the Crusaders. Precise surgical strikes, they don't exist. If you think they do, then why don't you talk with the surviving members of the wedding parties in Yemen and Afghanistan? And how did that come out? ISIS connections to Al-Qaeda are tenuous at present. However, just like when Sunnis felt threatened during the U.S. occupation, Fear military needs will inevitably drive them closer to Al-Qaeda. So what we fear, we actually create. Here's the irony. Back to the future. U.S. airstrikes on Iraq are being launched from an aircraft carrier named George W. Bush, who first involved the U.S. in a shooting war against Iraq in 1991's Desert Storm. Airstrikes will not solve anything significant. The short answer is through 9 years of war and occupation, U.S. air power in Iraq, employed on an unfettered scale, combined with full weight of the U.S. military on the ground, put billions of dollars in reconstruction funds, failed to resolve the issues now playing out in Iraq. Why would anything work this way since it has not worked previously? Here's what may work. Step one, stop digging the hole deeper. Look at, honestly, the imbalance in power between the Sunnis, who have been excluded and terrorized and jailed and killed by the person we put as the puppet in there, al-Maliki, and his regime. Demand the Iraqi government stop persecuting and alienating their own Sunni population. That is the actual root of this insurgent problem. Demand the Saudis stop funding ISIS. We know they're doing it. And why isn't their name up on any of the networks and showing how they're responsible for this? Oh, I forgot. They give $40 billion defense contracts. Demand the Iraqi government launch airstrikes in support of the Kurds as a show of support. Get the Iraqis to go after them. They have more than enough power. They have the Air Force. They have the arms. They have the men. They have everything they're supposed to have that we spent our blood and money giving them. Let them do it. Deliver humanitarian aid only through the UN and the Red Crescent. In Vietnam, this mistake was colloquially expressed as screw them, then feed them. So instead, divorce the U.S. good stuff from the bad U.S. stuff. Those are simply ideas, but I do not see any happy outcome for this, because for every one you kill, you've created 10 more martyrs. When are we going to learn something? And just a thought on, because it's going to pass and people will forget about it, we talk about being the most peaceful nation in the world. We talk about needing to police the world to stop anyone from having weapons of mass destruction. Does anyone stop long enough to realize we are the nation that used mass destruction and killed the most innocent people, civilians, not military people, and we've never apologized for it? John LaForge has something to say from that on Consortium News. And here's what he says, quote, "The rights and wrongs of Hiroshima are debatable." Telford Taylor, remember who he was, the chief prosecutor at Nuremberg. Quote, "But I have never heard a plausible justification for Nagasaki," which he labeled as a war crime. Now, in his book, The Atomic Cover-Up, Greg Mitchell says, quote, "If Hiroshima suggests how cheap life had become in the atomic age, Nagasaki shows that it could be judged to have no value whatsoever." And in fact, a U.S. writer, Dwight MacDonald, cites in 1945, quote, "The decline to barbarism for dropping half-understood poisons on a civilian population." The New York Herald Tribune editorialized there was, quote, "no satisfaction in the thought that an American aircrew had produced what must without doubt be the greatest simultaneous slaughter in the whole history of mankind," end quote. Mitchell reports that the novelist Kurt Vonnegut Jr., who experienced the firebombing of Dresden firsthand and described it in Slaughterhouse 5, said, quote, "The most racist, nastiest act by this country after human slavery was the bombing of Nagasaki." On August 17, 1945, David Lawrence, the conservative columnist and editor of U.S. News, put it this way, quote, "Last week we destroyed hundreds of thousands of civilians in Japanese cities with a new atomic bomb. We shall not soon purge ourselves of the feeling of guilt. We did not hesitate to employ the most destructive weapon of all times indiscriminately against men, women, and children. Surely we cannot be proud of what we have done. If we state our inner thoughts honestly, we are ashamed of it," end quote. If shame is the natural response to Hiroshima, how is one to respond to Nagasaki, especially in view of all the declassified documents from the government? According to Dr. Joseph Gerson's with Hiroshima's Eye, some 74,000 people were instantly killed at Nagasaki. Another 75,000 were severely injured, and another 120,000 were poisoned. Many of those people died. So we're looking at over 100,000 minimal dead in Nagasaki. And these were civilians. This was not a military target. If Hiroshima was unnecessary, how do you justify Nagasaki? The saving of thousands of U.S. lives is held up as the official justification for the two atomic bombs. Leaving aside the ethical and legal question of slaughtering civilians to protect soldiers, what can be made of the Nagasaki bombing if Hiroshima's incineration was not necessary? The most amazingly underreported statement in this context is that of Truman's Secretary of State James Byrnes, quoted on the front page of the August 29, 1945 New York Times with the headline "Japan Beaten Before Atom Bomb," citing peace bids. Byrnes cited what he called, quote, "proof that the Japanese knew that if they were beaten before the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima." On September 20, 1945, General Curtis LeMay, the famous bombing commander, told a press conference, quote, "the war would have been over in 2 weeks without the Russians entering and without the atomic bomb. The atomic bomb had nothing to do with the end of the war at all," end quote. According to Robert Lifton and Greg Mitchell's Hiroshima in America, 50 Years of Denial, only weeks after August 6th and 9th, President Harry Truman himself publicly declared that the bomb, quote, "did not win the war." The U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey, conducted by Paul Nitsch, less than a year after the bomb was dropped, concluded, quote, "certainly prior to 31st of December 1945, and in all probability prior to November 1st, 1945, Japan would have surrendered even if the atomic bombs had not been dropped, even if Russia had not entered the war, and even if no invasion had been planned or contemplated," end quote. Likewise, the intelligence group of the U.S. War Department's Military Intelligence Division conducted a study from January to April 1946 and declared that the bombs had not been needed to end the war. According to reports, Gar Alperovitz, in his massive "The Decision to Drop the Atomic Bomb," the IG said it, quote, "almost certainly that the Japanese would have capitulated without the entry of Russia into the war." And so it went. So we did not have to drop the bombs, but we did. I believe that that same identical mindset is still in play today, and that's why we see the type of destruction around the world by our military with no sense of moral or spiritual conscience. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Whoa.
Welcome back, everyone. To round out our program today, I'm going to take on several issues. And one is that this report just came out from Lauren McCauley over at Common Dreams. Quote, "Obama administration raking in billions off student debt. The student loan program isn't about helping students or borrowers. It's about making profits for the federal government." Quote, "Critics blasted the U.S. Department of Education for profiting off the backs of struggling students after a new projection by the Congressional Budget revealed that the federal agency is set up to make $127 billion from loan interest payments over the next 10 years. And despite promises to do the opposite, a student loan bill signed into law last year is driving up those interest rates even faster than projected, and that's according to an internal government watchdog report." Quote, "This exploding debt is crushing our young people," said Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts, speaking at a student loan symposium in Suffolk University Law School in Boston. Warren was one of the few lawmakers who last year voted against the passage of the loan bill. Quote, "Those students didn't go to the mall and run up a bunch of charges on a credit card. They worked harder, learned new skills that will benefit this country. They deserve our support." end quote. So, here is my take on this. For our generation, the baby boomers, many of us were able to pay for our college either through athletic or scholastic scholarships or through small payments that more often than not were paid for by the time we finished college or within a few years thereafter. But we never look back at that burden as hindering our capacity to make a living. We also had generally a lot more work available than there were people to fill those jobs, and so you never had to worry about being unemployed. Here's the reality. Today, the average student is bearing tens of thousands of dollars of debt. That is with a interest that when they miss a payment, it could be turned over to a private collection agency, and there's now debtors' prisons, and they actually had a SWAT team raid with full arms of a person who was delinquent on a student loan in California. So we have a serious issue. 55% of all graduates today are not able to find work or cannot find work where they had a degree, which means that they didn't need to go to college and incur that debt in order to have a job. Yes, there are some careers such as medicine, computer sciences, and engineering that will have jobs for people, but the reality is the vast majority won't, even from Ivy League schools. If you're going into money management, you're going into finance, yeah, there'll be some jobs for you. But more often than not, the average student will be living at home. For the first generation in American history, we have a majority of the students graduating having to go home and live off their parents. Now, keep in mind, many of these parents are just working class or middle class individuals who don't have extra money. So when they're buying something for their son or daughter who's living at home and paying their debt for them, they're having to create debt to do that. They're having to take out a second mortgage on their home if they're able to, and if that home is not underwater in their mortgage, they're having to sell assets they have. In fact, a new study showed that the average American does not even have $400 in savings. For them to go 1 week without an income, they would have to sell something or borrow in order to live that 1 week. That's how tough it is. And I'm talking about this is the reality of the world for over two-thirds of the American population. But we never focus upon the two-thirds who have not or are struggling. We focus upon that one group, that one-third that seems to have everything. That's who you see the glamour stories and those beautiful vacations. And not to say that many of those people have not worked hard and deserve and that and spend their money where they want. That's their business. And if their kid goes to a school and the kid doesn't find a job, more often than not, the parents will pay for that in total. And it still won't impact their bottom line. So the rules are made for those who have against those who have not. I do not believe that the government should be in the business of profiting off student loans. I believe that the interest on those loans should be forgiven completely. I would rather see that $157 billion going against the interest on student loans and also to change the bankruptcy laws the lobbyists managed and the banking community managed to put in place, which prevents a student from filing bankruptcy, no matter how dire their indebtedness, to get out of it. I believe that you should have the ability to get out of it. But that's not honest what they did. They did it based upon having a substantial influence over Senator Dodd. That's how they got it. So that is my approach to that particular topic. Separately, I want to spend a few moments talking about vaccines. Why? Because more and more research is showing that much of the scientific research on vaccines is fraudulent. I want to quote from Mike Adams, Natural News, quote, "Scientific fraud is so common in the vaccine industry, it's practically the default business model. The truth is that most vaccines don't work, so in order to make them appear to work, researchers routinely spike blood samples of vaccinated test subjects with antibodies, making it appear the vaccine caused the body to produce these antibodies. This is exactly what Merck does with MMR vaccines, according to a company's own former virologist who filed a False Claims Act with the federal government. It's also why up to 97% of children who contract measles or mumps were already vaccinated against measles and mumps. Now a National Institutes of Health-funded vaccine scientist who was celebrated as achieving a breakthrough vaccine against HIV has confessed to spiking the test subject blood samples with antibodies. This man had taken $5 million National Institutes of Health grant money to further his so-called research at Iowa State University. The mainstream media and vaccine advocates hailed his research as groundbreaking, quote, game-changing advancement in the search for an AIDS vaccine. But now it turns out the scientists committed outrageous scientific fraud that wasted taxpayer money and diverted resources away from other important research projects. So federal prosecutors have taken the extraordinary step of charging him with making false statements to the government. He now faces four felony counts, each of which carries a maximum prison sentence of 5 years. Yes, lying to the government is a federal crime, but the government is lying to us, and that's another matter altogether. Quote, it's an important case because it's extremely rare for scientists found to have committed fraud to be held accountable by the actual criminal justice system. That's according to Retraction Watch co-founder Ivan Ornsky in an ABC News article. Billionaire Warren Yellen will be an unlike any other, the collapse. So here's the latest. Do I believe that we live in a bubble society? Yes, we do. Wall Street is a bubble. The bond market is a bubble. The commercial real estate is a bubble, and they're trying to reinflate and have successfully done so in some areas. The commercial, the regular retail, residential real estate into a bubble. So the derivative market is a bubble. We have all these bubbles, which meaning that the real value is probably 50 to 70% less than the public perceived value. And I'm not the only one who thinks this. This is from Money News, quote, another horrific stock market crash is coming and the next bust will be, quote, unlike any other we have seen. That's the message from Jeremy Grantham, co-founder and chief investment strategist at GMO, a Boston-based firm with $117 billion in assets under management. Grantham pulls no punches when assigning responsibility for the coming financial carnage. In a recent interview with the New York Times, he calls Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen ignorant and says the Federal Reserve all but killed the economy recovery. Grimly, he adds, quote, we have never had this before. It's going to be very painful for investors. Well, I believe he is correct. I believe that we are in a bubble. I believe that bubble is going to burst, and I believe that the dollar will no longer be the reserve currency in the very near future, and therefore we should start getting out of debt, get off the grid as much as possible, save as much as we can, because we're going to need it. And the more skills that you can learn to be self-sufficient, there are a lot of groups out there that can help you with this. I suggest you start doing it because a lot of people think it would never happen to them, are highly committed to assets in Wall Street, and when those deflate, they're going to get creamed. They're going to end up broke. So be on the side of truth. Get ahead of this crash. I'm Gary Noll. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening, and I look forward to sharing more on tomorrow's program. Have a nice day, everyone.